Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Robert Holly with Home Healthcare News. Before we jump into my conversation with Andros Goggin, Home Healthcare and Hospice CEO and President Ken Albert, I want to give a shout out to our podcast sponsor, Homecare Homebase, whose powerful cloud-based home health software streamlines virtually every aspect of your business. Spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering quality care to the patients who need you. Visit hchb.com to learn more. Founded in 1966, Andros Goggin Home Healthcare and Hospice is the largest independent nonprofit home health and hospice provider in the state of Maine. On top of those core services, Andros Goggin also does palliative care, transitional care, and virtual care, all while working very closely with six area hospitals. While Andros Goggin didn't see a dramatic drop in home health census during the early days of COVID-19, it has had to overcome a series of challenges, according to CEO and President Ken Albert. And those challenges include overcoming the loss of Andros Goggin's front office and back office EMR right before COVID even hit. I talked to Albert at the end of May about Andros Goggin's COVID journey and what it means for a CEO to support employees during a life-changing experience. During our conversation, we also touched on the future of telehealth, the expansion of palliative care, and much, much more.
Joining me now for this episode of Disrupt is Ken Albert, the CEO and president of Andros Goggin Home Healthcare and Hospice in Maine. Ken, thanks for your time today.
Absolutely, Bob. I appreciate the opportunity.
So we're going to jump into the heart of the conversation, talk a little bit about the coronavirus and how your organization has had to adapt in just a second. Before I did, though, right before this taping, I was doing some background research, and I found out that you have a pretty unique background for a home health CEO. You previously served in a couple different capacities, I think, with the Maine Department of Health and Human Services, correct?
I did. Yeah, I joined that organization several years ago as a regulator for the home health industry, hospice industry, as well as the overall healthcare industry as the director for the Division of Licensing and Certification. And I also assumed the responsibility for the Chief Operating Officer for the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention during my tenure within state government.
That's really cool. And then even on top of all that stuff, you had something like 17 years of clinical practice experience in emergency and intensive care settings. I'm guessing that very diverse background, both on the government side and then in those emergency and intensive care settings, has served you pretty well as a home health provider.
You know, I think the nature of home health and hospice today certainly is becoming more and more regulated. And I think having the regulatory background as well as the clinical background lends itself to being a better leader from my perspective. I also had the privilege of practicing law for several years in the state of Maine and had some home health and hospital clients during that practice. So again, that lends itself to a different perspective of our operation. So to the extent you can come in with, you know, more angles of subject matter expertise, I think it just makes you an overall better leader and provider within the communities you're serving.
Let's talk a little bit about Andros Goggin Home Healthcare and Hospice too early on here. For our listeners who aren't familiar with your organization, could you share a little bit of basic info? You know, when did you guys first launch? I know you came to the organization in 2016, correct?
Correct, right. And the organization had been a client of mine previous to that. And so my interface with the organization was both as counsel, but prior to that, also as a clinician in the community, having referred and engaged with many of their employees. And I always knew that if I had an opportunity to jump in at a leadership level, it was the right time in my life, then I would do so. And it just happened to work out. Andros Goggin was founded in 1966. So we've been in operation for 54 years. We're the largest independent nonprofit provider in Maine. We're the only home care and hospice provider that is not affiliated with a health system, though we serve about six different hospitals throughout our geographic area and collaborate with the other health systems.
And Andros Goggin Home Healthcare and Hospice obviously provides home health and hospice care services. Anything else you guys do?
Yeah, so we view ourselves as really a healthcare company, not necessarily a home healthcare and hospice company. Certainly, the location in which we provide care is in the home setting, but we really have diversified our clinical portfolio. in addition to our headquarters in Lewiston, Maine, we also have 5 regional offices throughout the state and a hospice GIP facility as well, 14-bed facility. So those, in addition to the GIP work we do, we also provide an extensive array of palliative care services. Our medical staff has grown from 1 to about 11 over the past 3 years, working in hospitals and in the community, and with palliative care navigators to assist specialists and primary care with palliative care needs for their patients. We have a rapidly expanding telehealth program. We've been doing telehealth for 20 years. I actually looked back at a contract, our initial telehealth contract with a vendor, and that was 20 years ago. So we're skilled at remote patient monitoring and have been viewed as a collaborator with referral sources in that regard for many years. We also have a large transitional care division. So we work with third-party payers, Humana, Anthem, and others around navigating transitions of care. And for some of those providers, we have contracts where we actually do case management for them. And within the transitional care division, we also have a large program called Community Care Team, which is largely a Medicaid program where we case manage the highest 5% of Medicaid utilizers for roughly about 50 physician practices throughout the state. And they, based on a certain criteria and formula, patients who utilize those services would get funneled to us through an electronic portal, and then our staff picks them up and case manages those patients.
Wow. So it sounds like you guys are a very diverse organization doing a lot of cool different things. In terms of, you know, one thing we always like to do on Disrupt is give our listeners a sense of scale. Could you share how many people Andrew Scoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice cares for on a daily or, you know, yearly basis? Something to help paint a picture.
Yeah, I think, you know, on a daily basis, we are navigating the healthcare for over 2,000 patients a day.
Wow. And, you know, one of the reasons why we reached out to you specifically to come on this episode of Disrupt is because you participated in a great webinar about how important it is to invest in your frontline workers amid this coronavirus, but also just in generally. I want to talk about that in particular in just a second, but before we get into that, I just wanted to ask, how are you doing? How is Andrew Scoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice doing, you know, as we're talking here today on May 28th?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Bob. I think that, you know, for our organization, I'm not sure if you're aware, but back in November of this year, we went into emergency command. We lost access to both front office and back office EMR for 3.5 weeks. And so we converted to our entire staff. We converted to paper. We had roving medical records departments. We never skipped a beat, never denied an admission as a result of that work. So we were just kind of recovering from that when COVID-19 hit us in March. And so that we were already at a heightened pace, if you will, for several months leading into this. And so we just continued that work. And it's because of that added stress starting in November, it's been a long journey. And so I think it's also given us a unique perspective about the stress of change and emergency. But we're doing really well. And I think that's a real testament to certainly our team. We do our work with almost 500 employees and about 220 volunteers. And so the fact that we were able to get through that first big interruption and then find our way through COVID-19, you know, was, I think it was a helpful. You can say losing your EMR is helpful, but I think it was helpful to set the stage for us to be even more successful under the public health emergency.
Yeah, just in my conversations with providers, you hear everybody say how every day feels like a sprint. And for that to happen, and then for this unprecedented pandemic to strike, it sounds like you guys have been sprinting for the duration of a marathon.
We certainly have been. I took my first vacation last week, though, so that's also another example of how kind of things are level setting and we're just kind of falling into a new norm and kind of leveling out.
It sounds like you started to see the COVID-19 disruption in March. Could you just kind of walk me through what the past couple of months have looked like in terms of general impact on your operations?
Yeah. As an overarching sentiment there, Bob, I would say that, you know, it was a complete, and I've heard this from many providers across the country, It was a complete shift in our operational paradigm. So we really, from our patient service center, which is our intake area, all the way through to claim submission, every aspect of our operations has changed. And so redefining policies, procedures, workflows, educating personnel at all levels of the organization, we really had to kick that into high gear. That started off with what I would call a highly effective incident command. We have clearly defined roles and responsibilities for members of our incident command team. And that really was the launching point for us to identify the work that was necessary to accomplish in order to be successful in this environment.
What would have been some of the biggest challenges? You know, we hear about PPE, we hear about declined visits, the lack of testing, the list kind of goes on and on.
Yeah, for sure. So for initially, PPE for me was a major issue, and I also sit in the elected hospice seat for the National Association for Home Care and Hospice. And what I realized in talking with counterparts from across the country was that Maine was not alone. So when FEMA provides guidance to the states around PPE, they have categories or tiers, 1 through 4. Some states have adopted a 1 through 3 system. It's guidance. It's not mandated tiers. So different states do different things based on what their needs are. But unfortunately, home health care and hospice was never articulated categorically within those tiers at the national level. So what I realized in communicating with, in Maine, we have county emergency management agencies that report up through to the state emergency management agency, who collaborates with the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And what I realized was nowhere was it articulated that home care and hospice should be receiving PPE. And so I had to create opportunities to discuss that with the powers that be, including our congressional delegation, and including different media outlets to put a spotlight on this, both at the state level and at the national level, and also collaborating with NAC to make this a primary issue. For Maine, that was resolved working with Dr. Shah, who's now the current director for the Maine CDC, and he recognized very quickly on the importance of home health care and hospice in the healthcare continuum, and worked with me to ensure that home health and hospice organizations were included in the PPE distribution chain. So that was one really big area and that we had to address early on. I was really concern for my staff and our ability to take patients. I was not going to assume responsibility for care of patients if I could not put my staff out there in a safe way. You mentioned the declined visits, and I agree with that. I mean, I hear, you know, from other organizations across the country where they've seen upwards of 20 to 30% of their business decline. I have not experienced those same dips. As a matter of fact, you know, my home health census has stayed pretty flat. We have definitely seen a decline in hospice. But the biggest challenge, I would say, Bob, is negotiating. It was probably a slip, but it's apropos with facilities. So where our patients, for example, 50% of our hospice patients reside in either assisted living or long-term care facilities. And right, wrong, or indifferent, the facilities essentially locked the door and prevented access. So it was constant communication and working with facility administrators to have them understand the value that we could bring, the steps that we were taking to implement infection control standards and screening for our employees so that we could have access to patients who are in the facilities who are on a federal benefit. And I made it very clear that we were not going to discharge patients and that our documentation would reflect that we were denied access. That's not a good or a fun conversation to have necessarily with facilities who we have to work with on an ongoing basis.
You know, at Home Healthcare News, our coverage level is national. Sometimes we're not up to speed with what's going on a state-by-state basis. Is Maine generally taking steps to reopen, or is Maine still in pretty tight shelter-in-place orders?
So there is definitely steps to reopen. So Maine, geographically, for a size, you can fit all of the rest of the New England states into the state of Maine. And so for landmass, we have some counties in Maine that are very unpopulated. And so the case rates of positives or PUIs in those counties are quite low. So the governor's initial approach to Governor Janet Mills, her initial approach was to open very slowly over the course of, she had a 3-month plan. There was a lot of public pushback on that plan because of the fact that some of our counties have such low rates, as low as, you know, 6 cases, that the disruption to the economy, the cause and effect wasn't there. And so there's been a reworking of that plan. And I happen to work in counties where there is still a prohibition for restaurants and the like. So it's, you know, no gyms, no, you know, hair salons are just opening up with strict controls. So it depends on where in the state you are, what you're allowed to do. The beaches did just open up this week, but they're, you know, really encouraging social distancing and masking and so forth.
And I'll just share, I'm calling from Illinois, specifically here in Chicago, kind of a hotbed right now. Still lots mm-hmm. of cases on a daily basis. On a day-to-day level, our restaurants and gyms and bars are all still closed. I think statewide, there's a push to go to al fresco dining, but Illinois even is starting to reopen a little bit. Mm-hmm. But shifting gears a little bit, you know, you just highlighted a bunch of different challenges, PPE, some declined visits, though mostly you said your census was pretty stable, and not being able to get into the facilities you needed to at times. What have been the silver linings that you've seen amid all of this disruption, mm-hmm. or what have been your biggest success stories?
You know, I think at the national level, I'll say I think a silver lining has been, you know, I've watched the team at the National Association really engage their members around specifically what it is using data and mining for data to support what it is home healthcare and hospice providers need. That's been impressive to watch. I think the collaboration among the various national associations, stakeholder groups, you know, whether it's the Home Care and Home Care Association of America or NHPCO, and, you know, we're all communicating to ensure that our message to Congress and our message to CMS is uniform to the extent that it can be. I've seen a lot of collaboration there. I think that's great. Even with the American Hospital Association, you know, the National Association, NAC and AHA submitted was supposed to be a joint letter, but then AHA did a single letter, and then we did a complimentary letter to support a couple of initiatives there. So, you know, the collaboration is great. And even locally, the amount of communication that is occurring, you know, between our organization, the hospitals that we service, has been great. I mean, we've sat at their emergency response tables. They sit at ours. And, you know, it's been just a lot of effort to ensure that healthcare needs of our citizens are being met to the extent possible under a public health emergency.
In your conversations with hospital officials, do you get the sense that they appreciate the value of home health? Just anecdotally, it seems in our conversations that hospital officials know if home health providers aren't supported with proper PPE or, you know, proper screening tools, that their patients will be discharged, go on home health care, and very likely could end up back in the hospital. So hospitals seem to have an appreciation for home health care right now that maybe wasn't there before.
Yeah, you know, I want to give, you know, a shout out to the hospitals. I think that they've always, you know, valued the work that home health care and hospice does. You know, we have been a strong collaborator with the hospitals in our region that we serve. And it's not just about the referral for us. It's about navigating the healthcare for a patient across the healthcare continuum. So that's acute care, primary care, and post-acute. And so we've been viewed as that partner for many, many years. What I've seen, though, Bob, is a shift in perspective to understand, you know, we've always worked to demonstrate what the value proposition is to hospitals. I think our work around that, it will never stop, but I think it'll be markedly reduced after we've been able to convey to hospitals the critical nature of what we provide and enabling patients to continue to receive healthcare in the home setting and not have to burden emergency departments or inpatient settings.
For those of you who maybe need a quick reminder, we're speaking with Ken Albert, the CEO and president of Androscoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice. Ken, going back to that NAC webinar that was fairly recent, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, you talked about investing in your frontline workforce. What steps has Andrew Scoggin taken to support its staff and employees during this COVID-19 public health emergency?
So we've taken many, many steps, and I know we don't have time to go into all of them. So I just want to highlight a few of those, Bob. And I think that I've been quoted in several publications saying this, that the resilience of our workforce is paramount, and resilience is derived from knowing that you're cared for and knowing that you have a purpose and a mission. And so, that's really been the focus for think that our staff are not afraid, for their own health and safety, those of their family, but also what I've heard over and over is my staff do not want to be responsible for transmitting COVID to one of their patients or any members of their families. So you have to address the legitimate fears. And so that's the physical and emotional well-being component. In addition, there's all the financial elements in a public health emergency that we had to address. And then I really believe that and this was true in my work with the CDC as well, an effective response to an emergency situation starts first and foremost with communication. So those were the three-pronged approach that we took: effective communication, physical and emotional well-being of our personnel, and then the financial well-being of our staff.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd love to dig into some of those specific points. When we talk about those communication components, what are some examples of that?
Yeah, so communication in an emergency situation really does require that people not over-communicate. So in talking with some peers across the country, they were putting out emails several times a day, and that's over the top for our staff, and that becomes noise at some point. So you have to really focus and work with your staff to identify what's really important for communication. So we decided that a daily clinical update, and we branded our updates. So, for example, the header on our clinical updates was the same, clinical update with our logo, but it was a green banner as opposed to the employee updates that we do, which are for all of our employees, had a maroon banner. And then any of our external stakeholder communications, we did with a gold banner, just so that when you saw the color, you knew what you were about to receive for information. And that was well received by our staff. So again, daily clinical updates from our chief clinical officer. What are the most important things that you need to know today in order to provide safe and effective care and keep yourself safe? That was incredibly well received.
Yeah.
As the leader of the organization, I'm sorry, Bob, you were...
No, I was just going to say sifting through the noise on our end has been incredibly difficult too, because there's just so much information coming at you at a daily basis.
Absolutely. I think about the number of sales emails I'm getting, and these are people who are, trying to do their jobs and they're vendors and they're trying to sell a product. I would historically have tried to respond, at least, be polite about that. I can't anymore. There's just, in addition to all the other information that's coming at us, I completely agree, it can be overwhelming. And you translate that to a clinician who's trying to see 5 and 6 patients a day out in the community, in particular in our geographic area, where we have a lot of windshield time. That's challenging. So you have to be very concise. I also put out weekly employee updates. So these were like higher level organizational messages around how we're doing financially, what we're doing for our employees globally. And I shared those with our board. We are a nonprofit, so I shared those with our board of directors on a regular basis as well. And then we've historically had what I call management days. So we have one day a month where we have our management team come in from all over, and we have a formal process that we go through. And so we've had to really convert that to virtual, which has been challenging. But I think, allowing your management staff a safe venue to express what they're feeling, what they're going through, and how they, so that they can more effectively support their frontline staff, has been really critical for this, and allowing a place for any and all discussion to take place without fear of reprisal and knowing that it's safe and supported. I think that's been really critical.
And in terms of that financial investment, that component, is that providing something like hazard pay, or could you provide a little bit of detail around that point?
Yeah. So if you'll recall, when the EPSL, the Emergency Paid Sick Leave, and the Family Medical Leave Expansion Act came out, there was questions for providers about whether or not they would opt into those programs. Because from my perspective, the concern was, you know, and the federal unemployment benefit as well, some of our clinicians, especially our CNAs, PSSs, you know, they can make more on federal unemployment than they can working, you know, for us part-time or otherwise. So we had to be really thoughtful about what benefits we wanted to put out there for our employees. And we just decided that we're just going to make it all available. So the emergency, we opted in immediately to the Emergency Paid Sick Leave and the Family Medical Leave Expansion Act, which was not optional, of course. In addition to opting into that, communicating that effectively to our employee base and giving them a one-stop point of contact within human resources for them to be able to call with questions and see how the changes in law and regulations actually impacted them, put a lot of burden on human resources, but it was highly effective for our personnel. We also applied for and received monies from the Paycheck Protection Program right away. Like the day that it became effective, we had our application submitted and received that immediately. We also have a program where once a year you can cash in earned time or paid time off. It's called different things, EBT or PTO. And you can do that on the month of your anniversary, just as a mechanism of controlling cash flow around paying that out. We listed that you can still do that, but we also offered all of our employees to be able to cash out up to 2 weeks of their earned time in the month of May, early May. You know, the cash flow, we have many of our employees whose spouses or significant others, partners, were unable to work. And so the financial impact on the overall household. So it was just one more thing that we could do to infuse cash for our employees into their household budget. So then we also, under the CARES Act, we did provide also bonus pay for our staff. So all of our staff received bonus pay, but our clinicians received an enhanced bonus pay based on the risk that they were incurring in working in a COVID environment.
And that last point, you know, when you were highlighting the different ways broadly that Andrew Scoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice has invested in its employees, was that emotional component. I think you said, you know, resiliency really comes from that sense of feeling rewarded and knowing that you're doing important work. How do you get that message across? How do you make somebody feel like they're rewarded?
So first and foremost, I think you have to have an open door policy and an open heart that goes along with that, right? So your employees need to know that you're available to them, whether you're a frontline supervisor or anywhere is up through executive management. You have to have an open line of communication with your personnel and proactively and affirmatively reach out to your staff to check in and make sure that, for example, if you see somebody who is normally, you know, performs at a high level and they've got a med error or a needle stick or something along those lines, or two or three things that are happening clinically, are they exhausted? Are they overstressed? Having your eyes open and monitoring the clinical practice of your personnel. I think I was very forthright with my staff that I was going to keep people working. And I think that was, you know, making that promise and identifying alternative strategies for keeping people working. We have the Poland Spring bottling plant, for example, is not far from our headquarters, and they needed assistance with screening their employees. So when I had low work, if we kept track of all of our employees who had low work because they were unable to do the visits because either they were in a facility or the patient didn't want them in their home, we redeployed them to alternative settings to keep them working for the organization. We had a homeless shelter that was set up in our community to address the homeless population and screening. I had some employees who very much wanted to serve in that capacity, and we put them in there on a regular basis, working with that cohort of our population. So identifying opportunities. And again, when I talk about resilience, I mentioned this earlier, one of the ingredients in the recipe for resilience is knowing that you have a purpose and that there's a mission that you're serving. So keeping the purpose and keeping our mission alive and well and allowing them to engage in that without furloughs and without layoffs really did feed into that emotional well-being as well. Having said that, though, Bob, we did, you know, really expanded our occupational nursing work with our field staff and with all of our employees. We shifted about 85% of our workforce to the home setting, and that was a massive undertaking. But again, it was supplementing our culture of health and wellness for our and safety for our employees. Doing small things like, you know, sending a silly plant, you know, doing a drop ship of a plant with seedlings to allow the, you know, families with kids at home to plant them and have fun with it, you know, just small things like that really played well. There's also other strategies that are much more meaningful with regard to intent around emotional well-being, and that was we created a website for our staff coping in challenging times, and everything from yoga to childcare strategies and resources to music therapy to multiple opportunities, art therapies and things like that, multiple opportunities for our personnel to engage with some of those mitigation strategies to help their emotional well-being. And that we've had great feedback from our staff about that as well.
We only have a few minutes left here and a couple of other points I wanted to bring up before we wrap up this episode of Disrupt. I think the first thing I wanted to ask Ken, you know, there's a lot that's happened on the federal level to support home health providers and other Medicare providers, of course. Any actions that you found especially helpful? And then alternatively, is there anything else that you think still needs to be done to further support home health agencies?
I need more than a few minutes for this answer, Bob, but I'll try and do it real quick. So what was particularly helpful, I think, was in the hospice arena, using telehealth for face-to-face. That was really helpful, and I think very wise on the part of the government to do that. I still think, though, that we have, and also the 2% sequestration, lifting that to allow enhanced cash flow for home health providers, I think was really important. But a lot more needs to be done in that regard. I mentioned earlier, you know, revenues are down, you know, nationally for some providers on average of 20 to 25%. You know, we're asking, you know, Congress for an increase in rates for financial support of 15% during the public health emergency. Given the costs for providers out there, I think that's a very reasonable approach to ensuring that we know we're going to have closures of facilities, of providers out there, and we want to avoid that if we can, and we need a cash infusion to make that happen. Yeah. We're taking care of 3.3 million patients across this country on an annual basis, and I think that speaks volumes.
And, you know, we like to end these episodes on a positive note, not just talk about the challenges. Could you tell me, you know, a little bit about your plans for Andrew Scoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice in the year ahead? What are you looking forward to? What has you optimistic?
So I have to go back to my team again. So the incredible focus for me personally and for our organization, I think the incredible focus on mission and our vision and our values have just been really inspiring for me. And so I see a team that I work with that is ready to embrace a new normal, whatever that new normal is. You know, we're also in the process of implementing a new EHR right now as we speak. We're launching on June 1st to add a little bit more pressure to our environment and our clinicians, and they're still embracing that. So I see great opportunity there using expanded digital technologies that we have. Telehealth is another silver lining. I don't think that toothpaste is going back in the tube, Bob. I think, you know, TMS has really been encouraging telehealth use by home health and hospice providers. They haven't necessarily followed through to have that count for visits, face-to-face visits, and they're not necessarily reimbursing appropriately for it, which that's another story and something else we have to discuss with Congress, but telehealth and virtual health strategies. You know, I started 2 weeks ago a new director of virtual health because I see the capacity for handheld technology to be incorporated into plans of care and utilizing digital platform, you know, screen platforms to engage extended family in the individual patient's plan of care that we're taking care of. I think that is going to be the wave of the future. And it's, as I said, that toothpaste not going back in the tube. I also see expansion of palliative care really playing out here. As we look at serious illness and advancing illness in this country, palliative care, I've seen an expansion of that over the past 2 or 3 months. And I've also seen families who are removing their family members from institutional settings, long-term care, assisted living settings, in order to be able to have access. So then what does that mean for home health in responding to the seriously ill patient who's declining? So palliative care, again, has a role in addressing those patients who no longer want to be have access restricted to their loved ones.
This has been Ken Albert, the CEO and president of Andrew Scoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice. Ken, before we let you go, anything else you want to add?
Bob, I appreciate you taking the time to inquire about this. Obviously, I feel pretty passionate about home healthcare and hospice and ensuring that our workforce, not only here in Maine, my workforce and the rest of the workforce in Maine, but across the country are supported, because I think that the value that we bring into the home for the healthcare industry is very high.
Well, thank you so much for your time for this episode. It sounds like Andrew Scoggin's doing some really amazing work. The team here at Home Healthcare News wishes you and your team the best moving forward.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com. I'm Robert Holly, and this has been a production of Aging Media Network, Chicago, Illinois.